Hello, folks. Welcome to this AUCD NCBED Fellowship webinar. My name is Sue Lin. I'm here to welcome you as the project director of the AUCD NCBED Cooperative Agreement to this webinar. And we're really happy today that folks have been able to join us from across the country, lots of members of our network, and as also the trainees within our network that that are working in the areas of developmental disabilities and public health. I just want to let folks know that this webinar is presented and supported through the cooperative agreement that we have with the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities at CDC, and you know, we thank them for the support. Okay. Let me walk you through very quickly the agenda for today. We are starting with a short introduction by myself, and I will make this as brief as possible because I know all of you are anxious to hear about the research that's being done with our developmental disability fellow at CDC, as well as hear from her mentor at CDC about her experience in working with our fellow. So let me just go very, very quickly. The topic of the presentation today is long-term developmental outcomes of children with an inborn error of metabolism. It's an updated study that's being conducted by Dr. Kim Powell, who is our 2006 AUCD NCBED Developmental Disabilities Fellow. Kim is actually coming to the end of her second year fellowship and has done some wonderful research in collaboration and through the mentorships of the scientists at CDC. The discussion that we have on the webinar today is Dr. Kim Van Narden-Brown. I'm probably butchering Kim's last name, and I apologize for that. She's a epidemiology scientist and also the fellowship mentor for Dr. Kim Powell, and we're just delighted to have her here today. The presentation will be about 30 minutes between Dr. Powell's presentation and then the discussion provided by Dr. Van Narden-Brown. And then we will open the lines for you to have questions or any comments and basically a Q&A period at the end of it. Right now you'll notice that all of your lines are muted, and this is so that, you know, we don't have any interruptions as the presentation is taking place. But as soon as we can conclude the presentations, we will certainly give you an opportunity to ask your questions. Okay. Let me just tell you a little bit about the AUC, the NCBED Fellowship Program, before we begin. The Fellowship Program really provides an opportunity for graduate, postdoctoral, and mid-career professionals that are enrolled or employed at the AUCD network programs to further their professional development in the areas of public health and developmental disabilities, child health development. They are placed on-site at CDC so that they have firsthand experience what it's like to work at a federal agency. And since 2005, we recruited three fellows, and we're in the process of finalizing the selection of a fourth fellow, so we're very, very excited. Among the fellows that are currently working at CDC right now, we have Ann Ollickson-Schmidt, who is on the National Spina Bifida Program. She has been at CDC for 2 years and will be starting the third year of her fellowship. We also have Georgina Peacock. She is a medical officer fellow who's working on the Learn the Science Act Early campaign. It's an autism spectrum disorder public awareness campaign that is being launched from CDC. And then, of course, we have today's speaker, Kim Powell, who is on the developmental disability team. And then we're really delighted that we'll be having a fourth fellow join this great group of folks on the Learn the Science Act Early campaign as well. Okay. Just a little bit information on logistics. As I said, all the participant lines will be muted during the presentation. There will be a question and answer period that's facilitated by the operator, and our operator today is Taylor. So Taylor will be providing you with some instructions after the presentations on how you can pose your questions. However, we do have a webinar interface that is in conjunction with this audio portion of it being delivered through the teleconference line. And I just wanted to let you know that there is a text messaging feature that's on the GoToWebinar interface, and that if you have any questions at any point, please feel free to text in that question to me, and I will certainly share that with our speakers today. Okay? So this, it's a multi, there's a bi, well, okay, two different options for you to pose questions, and I hope that you will use them during this period. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and transfer control over to the two Kims, and then I'm going to ask them to take over in the presentation. So if you bear with us, we're going to transition into Kim Powell's presentation. Kim?
Was my screen showing?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Sue. Sorry, just getting the... sorry, Sue, just one more time. Is just the slide showing?
Yes, I'm seeing the presentation outline slide at this point.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my fellowship experience with the Developmental Disabilities Branch at the CDC. I'm going to just give you a brief background about myself and then kind of tell you a little bit about the branch and the organization of the CDC, and then talk to you a little bit about some of my fellowship activities focusing on one research project in particular, which is my metabolic study. And then my mentor, Kim Van Arden-Braun, will talk a little bit about her experience as mentoring my fellowship. Prior to starting at the CDC, my background was in nutritional science. I did my dietetic internship at the USC USED with the Children's Hospital of Los Angeles. And then I worked as a registered dietitian in pediatrics, focusing on inborn errors of metabolism and other developmental disabilities. And then I went back for my PhD in maternal and child health with a minor in epidemiology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. First one is the CDC and the branch I work with, the Developmental Disabilities Branch, because I found it a bit overwhelming to understand such a large organization at CDC when I was looking at fellowship. I thought I would show you some of the organizational structure. This diagram gives you an overview of how the CDC is structured with different coordinating centers for the various fields that they work on. The center I work within is the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities, and this is housed within the Coordinating Center on Health Promotion. So that's three divisions, the Division of Human Development and Disability, the Division of Hereditary Blood Disorders, and the Division of Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. And then within, at the division level, there are three branches, and I work with the Developmental Disabilities Branch with the branch chief, Marshallin Jürgen Alsop, and it's broken down into two teams, the surveillance team and the epidemiology team, and my supervisor, Kim Bonanno Brown, is the team lead for the surveillance team. The mission of the branch is to increase the awareness of developmental disabilities by providing effective public health educational interventions to the public and to providers, to strengthen the national capacity to conduct population-based surveillance for developmental disabilities, to enhance the capability and capacities for conducting epidemiologic research on developmental disabilities, and increase the capacity to plan, develop, and implement developmental disabilities prevention and intervention programs. To do an overview of the type of activities that occur within this branch, I've listed a few of the many projects that are going on. Two of the major surveillance programs that are ongoing are the MADSPA, or the Metropolitan Atlanta Developmental Disability Surveillance Program, which I'll actually describe in more detail in a few moments. This program tracks five developmental disabilities in Metropolitan Atlanta. And the ADAM network is the Autism and Developmental Disability Monitoring Network, and this uses the MADS methodology to monitor rates of autism spectrum disorders and other developmental disabilities across the United States. An example of some of the epidemiology studies is actually a new study that's just starting to get in the field called the SEED study. It was for the study to explore early development. It was formerly called CADRE, but they found that in a test subject that they didn't like that name, so it was changed to SEED. And this study is a case cohort study to better understand autism features and to examine different risks and protective factors associated with autism. And as Sue mentioned, one of the other fellows is working on the Learn the Signs Act Early, which is an example of a prevention program, which is a campaign to increase awareness about early childhood development and early warning signs of developmental disabilities, including autism, to encourage early intervention. In my fellowship, I worked mostly with the MADSPA data, so I'm going to talk in more detail about this program to just give you an example of the type of data sets that are available at the CDC. So as an ongoing population-based active monitoring program based on record review. They keep surveillance on 5 different developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, cerebral palsy, vision impairment, and hearing loss, and autism starting in 1996. Originally, they looked at children from 3 to 10 years old, and then now they focus on 8-year-olds, and they conduct surveillance in every 2 years. They use MADSPAs to investigate individual children. They look at educational records, clinical records, and service records. And this is all done within the 5-county metropolitan Atlanta area. It's also linked to other data sets such as birth certificate data, birth defects, special education, and many others. And this just gives you a wide variety of information and different variables to examine. And I, in fact, use this data set to link to my metabolic study. And this is a wealth of information. The objectives of this program is to provide regular and systematic monitoring of prevalence of selective developmental disabilities according to demographic factors such as age, sex, race, ethnicity, and to examine temporal trends in the prevalence of the condition, to assess the possible relationships between selective maternal and child characteristics noted on birth certificates and the occurrence of selective developmental disabilities, social, emotional, medical, and educational consequences of developmental disabilities, and to provide a framework for initiating special studies of children with selected developmental disabilities through the establishment of a large case series of such children. And most of my fellowship research projects are examples of some of these special studies that are possible through MADSPA. Specifically, my fellowship is an opportunity for graduate, doctoral, mid-career professionals enrolled or employed at AECD to participate within the CDC. It provides epidemiology training in developmental disabilities and child health and development. And my particular fellowship is, as I mentioned, with the developmental disabilities branch. In my particular experience, it's been, such an enriching experience. Beyond just experiencing the CDC, I've been able to attend lectures and seminars and conferences. I've presented my research at many conferences like the Maternal and Child Health EPI Conference, the International Society for Autism Research Annual Meeting, and, of course, the AUCD Annual Meeting. I've been able to take many different classes. I took some on SAS in Sudan to kind of get some more experience in data analysis, and there have been many opportunities to interact with colleagues across all the different disciplines, and, most interesting for me was to be involved with so many different research studies and other branch activities. And also the opportunity at CDC is that, it's very integrated, and I've been able to have opportunities at different levels of the organization. And I've learned kind of the overall purpose and the organization and then how the daily functioning of the CDC. And I've been able to present at the center activities such as Journal Club and Research in Progress and attend all the other meetings and speakers and celebrations that they have. And everyone at the Developmental Disability Branch was very welcoming and willing to talk with me and answer questions or talk about their projects. I was able to meet with the division director, Colleen Boyle, or our branch chief, Marshall Neve and Ossop, at any point to discuss different research ideas, which is just, I mean, so great that everyone was so supportive. And you could, of course, attend any meetings that you wanted. I was particularly interested in seeing what went on in the development of a national monocyte study, such as the SEED. So they welcomed me to attend all their weekly meetings and be involved however I wanted, and I helped out a little bit when they were training on the nutritional materials. But the core of my fellowship experience were my research. When I first arrived, I was brought right in to discuss all the different projects that were open to me, and particularly we tried to look at ones that were ready for me to work on immediately in my first year. So my first project was looking at the developmental disabilities and special education enrollment among children of multiple births. In the study, I examined the prevalence and trends of developmental disabilities and received a special education among twins, and I explored risk factors for having a developmental disability or receiving special education also among twins compared to singletons. And I also collaborated with another fellow to look at sociodemographic factors and autism spectrum disorders. And because of my background in metabolic disorders, I was very interested in looking more at this topic, and I saw that they had done a study in the past, and I talked to them about doing an update study and trying to expand on this a little bit, and they were very encouraging for this idea, and so I began to collect data for this study, which is what I've been doing in my second year. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this study and kind of give you some preliminary results, although it's still in progress. Co-authored the study with Kim Banana Brown, Marshall Nugent Alsop, and Lori Palmer from the Developmental Disability Branch, from the Pediatric Genetics team, Dr. Olney and Dr. Shapiro, and from Emory University, Dr. Ronnie Singh. This is a great example of how you can collaborate through different resources at the CDC. Just a little bit of background on inputs of metabolism. There are genetic mutations that interrupt some aspect of metabolism, usually affecting the breakdown of an amino, organic, or fatty acid, which means the children have problems breaking down either fat, a protein, or a carbohydrate. The most common example is phenylketonuria, PKU, and in this condition, the enzyme, phenylalanine hydroxylase, is either limited in activity or not present at all, and so the children have a buildup of phenylalanine in their system. And if it's not treated, it can lead to intellectual disabilities. Some of the other disorders can cause metabolic decompensation, behavioral difficulties, poor growth, neurological problems, and or death if they aren't treated. However, we found that if you start treating it in early infancy, you can prevent the neurological sequelae. However, the success of the treatment depends on the timeliness of detection and the initiation of treatment, as well as compliance and the type of disorder. The different ways to identify metabolic disorders include newborn screening, which is one of the largest public health programs in the United States. For my study, I used earlier years, so in Georgia, they screened for galactosemia, homocystinuria, maple syrup urine disease, phenylketonuria, and tyrosinemia. If children aren't identified through newborn screening, then they're usually identified through clinical symptoms. And with that, you have a little bit delayed in identification, so you can have more symptoms and complications and are more likely to have significant deficits in communication, daily living skills, socialization, and motor skills. Previously, my supervisor, Kim Van Arden Braun, looked at this issue in metabolic and endocrine disorders, and they found metabolic or endocrine disorders identified through newborn screening in 1981 through 1995. Among the 147 children with a positive newborn screen, 3 were identified with an intellectual disability. And of the 216 with a positive newborn screen, 9 were identified with a developmental disability less severe than intellectual disability. So with this study, I wanted to update this work into more recent years and expand the analysis to include children who were also identified clinically with an inborn error of metabolism. in order to examine the magnitude of the selected developmental disabilities attributed to mental block disorders in metropolitan Atlanta. So the schemes were to determine the number of children with a metabolic disorder who have a developmental disability or receive special education services, and to examine different factors that may play a role in the developmental outcome of children diagnosed with metabolic disorders, such as the type, the clinical versus newborn screening identification, the age of screen, the age of intervention, and the baseline of the metabolite when they began treatment, as well as their compliance to treatment. The study population included children born from 1988 through 2001 who were diagnosed with an inborn error of metabolism, either through newborn screening or through clinical symptoms. Their mother had to reside in the five-county area of metropolitan Atlanta because of the linkages to CDC data. Data for the Georgia Newborn Screening Program to provide information on children identified through newborn screening for the five disorders. And we looked at Emory clinical genetic records to identify the children with clinical identification of symptoms, and then to review all the children's medical history and treatment information. Here we used their MAGSA data, which I described earlier. We used their surveillance years 1996, 2000, 2002, and 2004, which included 8-year-olds. And then for in-between years, we were able to conduct a separate MAGSA review so that we could examine the qualifications for a case status for children not included in the biennial surveillance years. And then we also used the special education database of Metropolitan Atlanta, and these are electronic files from all 9 school systems in the 5-county area, which identify children who receive special education services who were 3 to 10 years old. And if they had more than one record, we used their most recent age and exceptionality. We linked all these data sets together and we had to identify children born from 1988 to 1996. We linked them with the MAGSA data to see how many children had a metabolic disorder and developmental disability. And from the 1988 to 2001 data, we linked the special ed data and the newborn screening clinical records to determine the number of children who have metabolic disorder and receive special education. And then once we had a list of cases, we had the physicians review the clinical genetic medical records to determine whether the developmental disability could have been attributed to a cause not related to their metabolic disorder. And because we're using historic records, so the information could be good or sparse depending on the records kept. So we had them assign a degree of certainty based on the MAGSA clinician review process. So they ranked them on a scale of 1 to 5 about how sure they were that the developmental disability could be attributed to the metabolic disorder. And then myself and Ronnie reviewed the laboratory results for the cases for a 3-year period to assign a level of metabolic control to kind of assess compliance to the diet. And we kind of made a consensus for each disorder based on clinical care, how to define the scale, which was on 4 points from fair to excellent. The analysis was to calculate the number of children with a metabolic disorder who have a developmental disability or receive special education, and then also to calculate the number of children expected to have intellectual disabilities using an annual and cumulative incidence rates from each disorder screened from in Georgia and the number of live births from the corresponding area of metropolitan Atlanta, and also to summarize the factors that may have contributed to the developmental outcome, such as newborn versus clinical identification. Now I'm going to go over some of the preliminary results, but of course we haven't finished, so these numbers will likely change, but I wanted to kind of give you a sense of what we found so far. This chart goes over kind of the flow chart for children identified through newborn screening. So these are the 5 disorders that were screened for in Georgia during the study years. So, you know, 500, 580,000 live births in the five-county metro Atlanta area from 1988 to 2001. There are 127 who were diagnosed with a metabolic disorder. And of these children, 115 had no developmental disability or were receiving special education services. 11 children were found to receive special education services, and one had a developmental disability. It's kind of a more detailed chart, but mostly I wanted to show you kind of the different kinds of exceptionalities we were finding based on either the MADSPA data or the special education data. What we were particularly surprised to see were so many of the Duarte galactosemia cases showing up under special education. Because this condition is actually considered benign and is only treated for about a year, it was sort of a surprise to see so many, and this was something that was found in the previous study as well. So we're actually doing kind of a side study to examine these cases more closely. And then we also looked at the children who were identified through clinical symptoms, which is this flow chart. So from 1988 to 2003, 42 children were identified clinically. Of these, 33 had no disability, nor were receiving special education services. 8 were receiving special education service, and 1 was found in the developmental disability. And again, this is showing you the different exceptionalities. And then we started to do the calculus, looking at the observed and expected number of children who you would expect to have a developmental disability based on the state numbers. And as you can see, you know, we have the column expected number of affected children if there was no treatment, which is kind of, you know, wouldn't happen anymore in these days, but this would be the worst-case scenario. And we, as you can see, we only observed one child with a developmental disability and several more with special education services. So, I mean, this just shows you how well the newborn screening and the treatment is at preventing these severe developmental disabilities, although there's some, you know, still concern about looking at some of the less severe developmental issues that show up in the special education services. Much of the study is to finish the review of some of the off-year surveillance cases, and the physicians are also re-reviewing the cases to ensure that the metabolic disorder is the reason for the different developmental issues. And we're also going to go through the entire case list just to confirm residency during the study ages in metropolitan Atlanta so that they'd be eligible for data linkages through a great software package available at the CDC. And then we'll prepare this manuscript for publications. So, that's kind of a quick review of my fellowship and my current research project. The past 2 years have been an amazing experience, and the CDC is a very supportive environment with, you know, as many opportunities as you're willing to take advantage of. And I want to acknowledge everyone at the Developmental Disability Branch and, of course, the AUCD who have made this fellowship possible. It's been very exciting of all the things I've been able to work on. Now you're going to hear from my supervisor, Kim Bernardin-Braun, without whom none of this would have taken place. She's been great to work with, and, you know, the perfect manager allows me to work independently and explore ideas, but always there when, you know, when I need her to help. So, Kim, if you want to talk a little bit, I can keep going with the slides for you.
Terrific. And, Kim, you can move through the slides, and I just have to say that it's reciprocal, and I had a wonderful relationship and time working with Kim. And I guess it's just because of the name. But in terms of, you know, my experience, I just wanted to walk through our process within our group and how we approach choosing a fellow, preparation for bringing a fellow in, and then what our expectations are, what the scope of our involvement is. So before we accepted a fellow and chose who we wanted, we have our project leads come together and we brainstorm as to what analytic projects we have that are available, and we identify multiple options and really work through what the details of those types of projects would be. And we lean towards an analytic project on an existing data set, so a secondary analysis of existing data because of the time frame of the fellowship, and hoping to get a project done and completed within that period of time, whether it be 1 or 2 years. So that's our orientation as we're coming into it. And once a fellow comes to us, so once Kim came to us, we knew which projects we were going to present, which we presented a number of them. We discussed which one she was interested in. And as a part of the orientation process, she went through and met with each of the project leads in our branch to give her some orientation and some ideas to how our pieces fit together, and also just the different programs and some of the details of them, and then where some of her analytic projects, some of those options, would fall under the various projects. The specific project that Kim chose to work on, which is related to the MADSA data, which is what she described earlier, is a very detail-oriented, as you can probably imagine, active ongoing population surveillance system. And so we have a rather large staff that works on implementing the program. So we have an established orientation module manual that each new team member actually goes through, and so Kim was a part of that process. And what that orientation module training manual is going through essentially each step of the methodology that we carry out with the MADSPA program. So from our community liaison, who meets with our data sources to get in our records to identify kids for ascertainment, to our programmer, and so that Kim could see that step in the process, to our project coordinator and our program manager, who does a lot of the data cleaning, to someone like myself, who does the analysis and working towards getting data to publication stage. So we hoped to bring Kim in on not only the bigger picture, but the details and some of the nitty-gritty of the process, and she'd be working with the data. In terms of the process of how Kim and I worked, we would meet on a regular basis. We'd formally meet once a week, but we'd often talk during the week if issues had arisen. We'd troubleshoot both little issues in terms of data cleaning, but also some bigger, obviously, conceptual issues with her projects. I'm ultimately responsible for the scientific and programmatic support, and it's been a pleasure working with Kim. And so it's been a nice back and forth being able to collaborate on these projects. And as Kim mentioned, we really try to facilitate and encourage presentation of her work in progresses at our DD scientific meetings, which are a smaller group, but it's still branch-wide. We have journal clubs that are division-wide and sometimes center-wide, and then research in progress meetings, which are our Friday meetings, which are division-wide. So varies in terms of the diversity of the audience, also the size of the audience. And Kim actually took the opportunity to present at each of these and did a wonderful job. So I think it was a good experience for her, but it was also a great learning experience for the branch and for the division to learn about her projects and also her process of going about and going through the fellowship. So as Kim mentioned, as I mentioned, we've got a number of intramural and extramural programs within our branch, and so our goal was to expose her to the projects, and also particularly the existing projects, but the ones that were in development. And so it was, I think, a nice balance. I hope it was a nice balance, because we had our existing extramural surveillance activities that are part of the ADAM network, the National Network Conducting Surveillance of Autism primarily, and then the SEED project, which is also extramural, but was really in the development phase when Kim began, and they're just beginning to get in the field. So she was able to really see the beginning stages and now the beginning of implementation and all the growing pains that are involved. Kim took advantage of various CDC courses that were beyond our branch, FAST courses, and also going to outside CDC to other federal agencies to learn about Medicaid data and bring that information back to us. So it was mutually beneficial. And in terms of projects Kim shared with you, the metabolic project, which is an excellent effort, and we're hoping to get that publication together shortly before the end of her fellowship, and hope to submit that to a peer-reviewed journal. And that's really the ultimate concrete goal of the fellowship from our perspective, is to have a rather comprehensive and complete learning experience from the branch perspective, but also to get a concrete project out as as a learning experience and also to have a publication by the time the fellowship is over. So not only has Kim actually, I think, gotten to that point with this one project, which she's really taken the lead on and taken a tremendous amount of initiative, but also she's done a number of other oral presentations, and there are the other projects which she mentioned but didn't go into great detail about because of time, but our multiple birth project and linking that to special education outcomes. So in addition to the one project, which is the, you know, ultimate goal to meet that expectation, there also are these other projects that hopefully will have a good place by the time she leaves. So, Kim, do you want to go to the next one? Thank you. You know, again, as I mentioned, the finishing one analytic project. In terms of our reflection on the past 2 years and the AUCD fellowship experience from our standpoint, from my standpoint personally, it's been a great match between our goals and activities and the training and experiences that Kim has brought to our group. And as she described her background in training in nutrition and metabolic disorders and developmental disabilities, finding the metabolic project and linking that with Kim really has been a very nice match. Kim brought very strong analytic and writing skills, which has made it a pleasure to mentor her, and she's always been willing to participate in a wide variety of activities, and not only large, but small, and that has always been very helpful. It's always ideal to have a team player who is positive, enthusiastic, and energetic to be a fellow or any member of the team. So I guess I'd like to thank AUCD for matching Kim with us, because it's really been a lovely experience. And I think that's it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. This is Sue. Taylor, are you there?
I am.
Could you provide the participants with instructions on how to start that question and answer period?
Certainly. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your touchtone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Your first question comes from Laura So.
Oh, I thought this was just to put on the speaker. I would like to, if we can, look back at the chart that you had when you were talking about the different types of inborn errors of metabolism that you found.
Laura, this is Sue. Did you have particular questions about the tables or charts?
No, I want to look back at it again and then go from there.
Okay, great.
So I have a chart that you're looking for?
Yeah, that's great.
Other questions?
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Your next question comes from Arnold Byronbaum.
Hi. Thank you for the excellent presentation. I wanted to ask Kim a question about her career. What other career options did you have available when you took the AUCD fellowship?
I actually had just graduated from my PhD, so I was kind of looking between probably 5 or 6 other postdoc fellowships.
Uh-huh.
At different, you know, agencies from, you know, the NIH to local smaller things within the university and then the CDC. I was actually looking for a way to work at the CDC, and I found the AUCD fellowship. So
it was very convenient.
Yes, it was very convenient to have that in my background. I didn't know about it, so sort of one of those things that came up in one of my searches. So.
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. There are no further questions.
Well, I have a question that just came through the text, and the question was for both Kims. How did the results that, or the preliminary results that you've reported are they reflective of other areas of the country?
Well, what's interesting with the metabolic disorders is it was actually a unique situation with the CDC to have such a population-based data set, because it's very hard to get the, because it's like a rare disorder, to actually pull together this kind of data. So there isn't a whole lot of population data like this out there. We have seen with, like, the Duarte glaucoma cases, some mention of speech and language issues. So this is kind of real data to confirm it. And a lot of smaller studies, it seems to be similar in prevention of intellectual disabilities, but a lot of it is case reports. So this is one of the few studies out there that has that population base, which should be hopefully be very exciting when we get it all finished.
I'll just add to that, Kim. In terms of generalizability of the MADSA data, it's clearly, you know, limited to Atlanta in terms of the five-county metro area, in terms of what it's representing, but it is a relatively heterogeneous demographic in terms of what the five-county represents. So as Kim's saying, it is population-based, so it does add a strength to the findings. Our hope, now that we have a national network of sites doing surveillance for autism spectrum disorder, some sites doing surveillance for intellectual disabilities and cerebral palsy, where that infrastructure is in place, that there might be some capability to do an analogous analytic exercise, an analogous abstraction effort to link to newborn screening records at other sites and to be able to see whether these findings can be replicated. So, of course, that would require additional funding as a small special study. But now that we have a number of other sites across the country, which would just add sample size, add greater diversity in terms of the populations they're covering, there's the hope that in the future we might be able to replicate some of these findings.
Great. Thank you. Taylor, do we have other questions?
You have one question from Katie Beck.
Hi. I am a clinical child psychology intern at the Mailman Center for Child Development, and I work on an interdisciplinary team, and we often do evaluations for children suspected with pervasive developmental disorders, including autism and other diagnoses on the spectrum. And I wanted to get your expert opinion on some of the things that have been in the news lately. I have, you know, seen some research on the very few cases of potential metabolic disorders and the connection to the vaccine autism, or the connection between vaccines and autism. And while I know that it's a very small group that, you know, that actually happens for, what I was more interested in getting your opinion on, maybe some reliable literature or something that I could share with parents who often have this concern and just want to know some more information. I like to be able to point them in a direction with good information.
Kim, do you want to address that, or do you want me to address it? I can. I'll step in. But I think you're referring probably to the recent court case with the mitochondrial disorder, the 9-year-old girl in Georgia. Is that what?
Yes.
I think you're referring to. Okay. There is a study that was published in Portugal that looked into the relationship between mitochondrial disorders and autism. So that is a resource. There's very little data on mitochondrial disorders and autism. You know, it obviously was a very rare situation in terms of having a pre-existing mitochondrial disorder and then the symptoms of the spectrum of autism, and whether there was any causal association, I think, is still in question. In terms of actually having any real hard empirical data, we don't have any with the surveillance data that we have, but we have the capability of doing special studies to try to investigate it further. But right now, from where we sit, we don't have any data to actually explore the relationship further, at least within the developmental disabilities group. But there is, as far as I know, there was one report in Portugal where an investigator did look further into that association.
Okay. I know the CDC, someone from the CDC actually put out a press release or commented on the situation and gave some statistics. Is there anything on the website or anything, just so more of a piece of literature to kind of reassure parents that just want to know more information about it, to kind of show them that the connection is very questionable, and it's very small chance.
And you can go to our website, and when you go to the CDC website, and you can navigate down to our center and to autism. And so I think that you'll find information there that'll be helpful, that'll be reassuring, particularly with the vaccine issue.
Great. Thank you.
Both Kims, I've just had another question come in from John, and it says, could you comment on the findings about the high prevalence of variant galactosemia among the population receiving special education services? And then the second question from John is, do you think that extending treatment would influence this?
Yeah, it was actually surprising, as I mentioned, because Duarte galactosemia, which is the variant galactosemia, is considered benign, and it varies from state to state whether or not they treat it. In Georgia, they actually treat these children for 1 year. We don't know that if treating longer would make a difference, because at the end of the 1 year, they're challenged with a normal diet. And obviously, if they didn't meet the challenge, then they would continue to be treated. So the question is more, is it kind of the initial level or the length of time it takes to bring the level down? We really need a lot more research in that area, but it's never really been that much of a concern before. So it's sort of interesting to see that it's still kind of coming up. And we're looking more carefully at these cases to see kind of why they're receiving special education services. And most of them seem to be centered around speech and language issues, which is something we see with the classical galactosemia, which are where the children are more affected. So, we're looking more into it as sort of a side study to try to figure out a little bit more information. As far as the treatment, it's still a little bit of a question mark of what might be the root cause of it, the length of treatment or the initial kind of insult of the galactosemia. And Kim, do you have any other comments?
No, I think you captured it.
Great. Taylor, at this point, do we have any other questions?
Not at this time.
Okay. I just had one more question that was posted through the text messaging is, Robert commenting on how it was an excellent presentation, and whether or not the presentation will be available for folks to take a look at after the presentation. And my answer to that would be, if it's okay with both Kims for us to archive the presentation on our website, we certainly be happy to provide that to the participants. And also to send out an email to let folks know where they can link to on the web to get that presentation. So, okay. If we have no other questions at this point, we're coming up to the close of an hour. I want to take this opportunity to thank Kim Powell and Kim Varnarden and Brown, hope I have pronounced it correctly, to present on this webinar, to share both of their experiences as a fellow and as a mentor, and also to give us a first look at a study that they're doing at CDC. And also want to thank the folks that have been participating on the call with us today to give us comments on what they thought of the webinar. So after you leave the webinar, you will receive a survey from us, and we would love to hear from you about your comments and your input on how these webinars are going. So with that, I will say goodbye, and thank you all again for your participation, and thank Kim and Kim for your presentations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.